Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. The U.S. military has resumed air evacuations of Haitians injured in last month's devastating earthquake. And a group of U.S. missionaries has been detained on kidnapping charges, highlighting sensitive issues of sovereignty that challenge relief operations. Joining me in the studio to talk about how Haitians are coping in the aftermath of the Western Hemisphere's worst natural disaster, Manuel Roy Franzia of The Washington Post. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Susan.
And we're also joined by Mark Schneider of the International Crisis Group. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
First, we're going to just spend a couple minutes talking by phone from Port-au-Prince with NPR reporter David Shaper. David, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you much for having me.
David, could you describe the situation there today? Are people better able now to get food and water?
You know, food and water is getting out. Water in particular has been distributed pretty well. I see water trucks a lot when I'm out. I see people carrying buckets of water back to their tents or wherever they might be staying. And it seems like water was the first priority and it was distributed very well. Food has been much more difficult to get out to people. They've changed the system of delivery of food rather than trying to just, in this scattered approach, get food out to, a million plus homeless people out here. That they've gone to distributing the food in 16 fixed points in the Port-au-Prince area anyway. And then distributing vouchers for people to redeem for food, so they know that people are only getting one supply at one time. They're shifting gears from daily meals to giving people a more sustainable supply of food that could last a couple of weeks. Bags of rice, 55-pound bags of rice that should last a family of five about 2 weeks if they supplement it with other foods, is pretty much what we see going out now. And it's getting better. There's still a lot of people who haven't gotten the aid that they need in terms of food, but things gradually are getting better. But there is still a logjam, too, here of supplies. There's warehouses that are full of supplies that they're having trouble distributing. That's food, that's medicine, and other things. And planes and ships still are not able to get in a very efficient manner. Trucks coming over from the Dominican Republic are very slow. The road has been choked, and a trip that I guess used to take about 6 hours is now two or three times that.
You talked about 16 fixed sites for people to go to get food. Do people there know where they're supposed to go to get food?
Well, the way they're doing this is, they're using the relief organizations, the NGOs, groups like Catholic Relief Services and others who are on the ground working in certain geographic areas, and they're partnering up with local organizations and local community leaders. And what they do is within their one fairly big broad section, one of these 16 zones that they've set up, they go day by day one small piece of that area, and they try to saturate the area, contact people in a tent camp, for example, or in a certain neighborhood, and say, here's where the food's going to be, here's your ticket, you go tomorrow. And they do one section per day, and then that group goes the next day to pick up their food. One of the problems I've heard is that they're doing this during the day, the distribution of these food tickets and these vouchers. And the problem is that a lot of people leave their little settlement there and go out and try to find food on their own during the day, find work on their own, and find other things that they need. So some people are missed. And the communication, they're using the radio and they're using bullhorns sometimes as they go through these areas, is still a little spotty. And I've talked to some people who were getting food who knew other people in their area didn't know about this and hadn't been contacted. And so there could be some gaps. And, the United Nations World Food Program, which is overseeing this overall effort, has a target of reaching 2 million people in the next 2 weeks. They feel like they've gotten to about 300,000 just in the last 3 days, which is a remarkable improvement. But they acknowledge that there's just no way to ensure that every single person who needs it is going to get food. It's just too difficult of a situation, too chaotic of a situation right now.
Yeah, what an enormous challenge. Tell us the latest on the bizarre case of these American missionaries who are accused of trying to kidnap 33 Haitian children. What's the latest development?
Well, it is kind of a strange situation, isn't it? It's these Americans today. Yesterday, a magistrate, an investigating magistrate that's kind of overseeing the case, interviewed all of the women, the American women who were here, and to get their story about what their intentions were, what they were trying to do, why they didn't have the right paperwork. Today, that magistrate is meeting with the men in the group, so the other five of the 10 who have been detained, to try to get more answers, try to make sure that everybody's kind of singing from the same songbook. So. It's not too, just to make sure that there's nothing in their story. But there's no resolution, as I understand it. There's still some talk about whether or not they're going to go forward and press criminal charges, or whether they would let the American authorities handle it and maybe press charges themselves. The big problem is there is no court. The buildings, most of the government buildings that this would happen in are destroyed. Court documents are not available, and some of the people they would need are not available. So it's a logistical nightmare for them as well to try to prosecute these people. But there will be a local district attorney who will be looking at the case once this investigating magistrate is done with all of the interviews and collecting the evidence. So it's still a case that's up in the air. We don't really have any idea yet how it's going to be resolved.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
David Shaper of NPR, he was talking to us from Port-au-Prince. Well, Manuel Roy Franzia, you have spent a lot of time in Haiti, got there just a day and a half after the earthquake struck, came back last week, and you spent time there before, and I know that you've written about this tradition called Restivix and how that may be complicating the case we were just talking about with David about these American missionaries. What is that tradition?
Yeah, well, culturally, I think this could be an underlying complicating factor here, right? Restavik is this tradition in Haiti of families actually sending their children to indentured servitude with wealthier Haitians. There was a report that recently came out from a NGO based here in Washington that suggested that maybe more than 200,000 children are in this sort of indentured servitude. And what's interesting about this is it is not the question of whether these missionaries were involved in that, but the cultural underpinnings that made it somehow acceptable for some Haitian families to send their children elsewhere with the expectation that they might have a better life there. It just adds a layer of complication to this very complicated story.
Mark Schneider, I know you yourself have spent time in Haiti. What's your perspective on this missionary's case?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. To some degree, it reflects the view from people on the outside that they can almost go in and do whatever they want in Haiti, and that the local government, given its weakness and fragility, has no real capacity to respond. On the other hand, one would hope that there was a humanitarian motive behind what they were doing in terms of trying to help either orphans who were in the process of being adopted, and this all then was thrown aside by the earthquake, or on the other hand, that they simply wanted to help individuals, children that they saw on the streets. And it may well be something much more serious and onerous.
You know, Mark, I think one of the interesting aspects of this is that the Haitians have been very willing to hand over control of parts of their nation to international groups and to, in some cases, the United States. The United States runs the airport. The United Nations is largely responsible for security in Port-au-Prince. But here we have a situation where the Haitian government seems to be saying, hey, we're here, and we are a sovereign nation, and we have a right to enforce our laws and to prosecute people who we think have done something wrong. So it's an interesting assertion of Haitian sovereignty and Haitian government authority in a situation where there's been a great lack of that.
To some degree, I think you have to remember that the decision was the decision of the Haitian government, President Preval, to allow the U.S. military to take over the airport because no one else could run it at the time, in order to permit the humanitarian flights to arrive. And second, with respect to security, again, the Haitian government had agreed several years ago to a United Nations Chapter 7 mandate to provide security. They had not agreed to allow anyone who wanted to pick children off the streets and take them out of the country.
This issue of sovereignty, who's in charge now? Is there, in fact, an operating Haitian government that's able to act like governments do even in situations of crisis?
I had an interesting experience right after the hurricane. After the earthquake, conflating my natural disasters here. I spent a day with the city government of Port-au-Prince, which a lot of people haven't talked about, but there is a city government. They had one or two functioning cars. Their city hall had been destroyed. And most of the day, they were looking around for a place to hold a meeting. They spent an entire day looking for a place to hold a meeting. And at the end of that, were able to get a federal government building, a government of the national government building borrowed. And when they arrived the next morning, I went with them. The guard at the front gate would not let them in. I thought that told us a lot about the situation on the ground.
Well, you have to remember this, and I think it's important for the listeners to understand, this is the worst natural disaster in terms of lives lost and damage in the history of the Western Hemisphere. And in the end, it may well turn out to be one of the two or three worst natural disasters in terms of lives lost across the globe.
We're talking with Mark Schneider. He's Senior Vice President and Special Advisor on Latin America for the International Crisis Group. He's also a former director of the Peace Corps. And also with me in the studio, Manuel Roy Franzia. He's a reporter with the Washington Post who's been covering the situation in Haiti. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll soon go to the phones and take some of your comments, 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking this hour about the situation in Haiti 3 weeks after that terrible earthquake. Now joining us by phone from the State Department is State Department spokesman Gordon Duguid. Mr. Duguid, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. You're quite welcome, thank you for having me.
We have been talking about the case of those Baptist missionaries. Is the United States trying to seek their release, prevent them from being charged and tried in Haiti?
Well, what we're doing is we are providing them with consular support, which is our normal function for Americans who have been arrested in a foreign country. The Haitians have given us unlimited consular access, and we have been able to meet with the group. We have been able to provide some necessary medication that one of the group needed. We're following the case quite closely. We've made sure that the group understands its rights under Haitian law, and we have provided them with a list of lawyers who could act on their behalf. My latest information was that they hadn't chosen to seek a lawyer at this point, but as one of your previous guests had said, this is in the Haitian system right now, and we need to respect their sovereignty at this point.
Well, I have seen news reports that suggest since the situation in Haiti is so chaotic, the United States might be willing to bring charges here in the United States to resolve the situation. Is that a possibility?
Well, we haven't made that determination yet, and I don't think that the Haitians have either. It would involve an extradition process, and no one has started that on the Haitian side. Therefore, you know, there isn't a U.S. response to that right now. We, of course, are always concerned with the welfare of U.S. citizens abroad and would like to see that their case is handled in the fairest way possible. And I'm sure that we will be working with the Haitian government to provide whatever assistance we can in the coming days. But as one of your guests pointed out, it's still at the investigating magistrate phase of the case. And so to plan for another or any other eventuality before the magistrate rules is a little premature at this point.
Well, we've seen Haitian officials be very grateful for American aid, but the prime minister there seemed to take quite a bit of umbrage at what these Baptist missionaries were doing or trying to do in taking these Haitian children out of the country. Is that your sense? What's the feeling of the government there?
Well, the government was quite worried early on, not just about Americans who might be looking to, you know, help children or to take children to some other port of safety, but we, the U.S. government, that is, the embassy in Port-au-Prince, early on flagged the danger of having traffickers take advantage of the situation on the ground. The United States has moved a number of orphans from Haiti to the United States, but under the strictest controls. These children had already been in the adoption process. They had been paired with American parents. Those parents had been fully investigated and vetted and chosen through both Haitian and American laws. And so we have been moving children under those circumstances. But we are processing no new applications for adoptions, and the reasons for those are several. First, in a situation as chaotic as it had been on the ground in Haiti, children do get separated from their parents. That doesn't mean that they are orphans. It means that somebody is looking for them somewhere, and you don't want to have a double tragedy in which the child suffers first a traumatic experience like the earthquake and then is taken from family and put somewhere else, even if the intentions are to stop that child from suffering. The other thing is that you can't deal with the problem in a piecemeal fashion. Save the Children is doing wonderful work in Haiti with orphans and with unattended children. The UNDP is looking at this. I know that a number of groups under the UN umbrella are providing shelter for unattended children. They are working to make sure that they first have their basic needs of food and shelter and water and medical care, and then are looking to find their families and reunite them, no matter how extended the family might be. Save the Children told me of a case. I've just returned from Haiti. I was there until this past Friday. Save the Children told me of a case where they had a child in their custody who didn't know where any of his family were, and they finally found the child's mother in a hospital in Santo Domingo. So, you know, families can become quite widespread, and you should not assume that children are orphans because they are unaccompanied. And I think this is what many in Haitian society, particularly in the government, are worried about, that people are making assumptions that will lead to a second tragedy for these children.
Just briefly, there had been a lot of confusion about those U.S. military flights, the air evacuation of critically injured earthquake victims to the United States. Those flights have now been resumed. Is that right?
That is correct.
And why were they suspended for a while?
Well, they were suspended for a while for a number of reasons. One of the major reasons is that we now have the USNS Comfort in Haitian waters with 2,000 beds and the capacity to take severely injured cases. Now, when those beds become filled near to capacity, of course, we have to look for other places for the severely injured to go. And there were some concern about not only capacity in South Florida, where most of the early severely injured were being taken, but also the ability of the military to provide enough flights at the right time. Those issues have been worked through. There is a protocol on the ground. It was in effect earlier on, but it has now been strengthened, whereby injuries are dealt with in a triage fashion on the ground. If they are severe, they are referred to the U.S. NS Comfort, and if they are too severe for the Comfort, then they are referred to a medevac, which will take them to a U.S. facility in most cases, not solely in Florida anymore, but also surrounding states who may take them. There are also surrounding mm-hmm. nations who have offered their hospitals.
But now Governor Crist complained in Florida about Florida having to shoulder too much of the burden. Was that a big factor?
Well, I think we listened to the governor's the governor's statement, and it shouldn't be that the burden is borne by any one state or any one nation in this. This is a catastrophe of epic proportions, and there is so much work to do that everyone needs to lend a hand who can in order to try and alleviate the suffering. So the capacity of any one health system to deal with the number of injuries is a question, and it's one that has been looked at and that we're trying to continually address.
All right. Just very briefly, of the Haitians who come to the United States for this medical treatment because they're urgently ill, are they allowed to stay here once they get better, or will they be required to go back to Haiti?
Well, there is a program going on now being run by Customs and Border Patrol under the Department of Homeland Security called Humanitarian Parole. And it's not simply injured Haitians who have come to the United States under humanitarian parole. Some orphans have also come under this program. That is, they don't have to have a visa of a specific type or a specific duration. Now, DHS has the exact details, but I believe there is a 2-year limit on humanitarian parole. Some of the injuries have been so severe that it will take a lengthy recuperative period in order for the individual to become well. No one certainly wants to take a person who is in the stages of recovery and put them into a situation that will, again, threaten their health.
And when humanitarian parole, would that be available for tens of people, hundreds of people, thousands of people? What kind of numbers?
Well, I don't think that there has been a cap or a limit talked about. Each humanitarian parole case is adjudicated individually on a case-by-case basis. For example, for some orphans who did have American parents identified but did not yet have a visa issued or perhaps some of the other documentation, that is an easy decision to make. We have so far only transferred just about 600 orphans from Haiti to the U.S. So that's a very small number, not all of them through humanitarian parole. Injured, that is, again, I believe a couple of hundred cases who came on humanitarian parole. There's also humanitarian parole for Haitians who have American citizen family members, and this is in particular in relation to children. There are a number of Haitians who are minors and who are American citizens and have one or another parent who is not an American citizen. If that parent is escorting the American citizen child to the U.S., they also come under humanitarian parole. I think at the moment, I haven't the latest figures in front of me. I would be surprised if we were over 1,500 cases in this particular instance.
All right. Gordon Duguid, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
That's Gordon Duguid. He's a spokesman for the State Department, joining us by phone. So, Mark Schneider, what did you think about what we heard from Mr. Duguid?
Well, I think he's correct, but I think that there are two questions. One is, in terms of the flights for injured children and others, serious medical evacuations, I think that clearly that should never have been suspended, and that should have continued and be now continue, and they should have access to any hospital in the country. The second is that in terms of admitting legally Haitians during this period of crisis, last year a total of 25,000 Haitians, some 15,000 who went through the normal immigration, another 10,000 adjusted their status here. So 25,000 normally are permitted to come in. It seems to me during this period of crisis, at least tripling that number for the next 3 years would be appropriate.
Manuel, we heard the State Department spokesman kind of downplay the issue of whether it was complaints from the governor of Florida that prompted these flights to be suspended. What is your sense of why they were suspended for a while?
I think that in these sorts of situations, bureaucracies get tangled. We saw it with the flights. I saw it on the ground when I was there. I can remember one day very vividly. I was in one of these encampments where people have set up makeshift tents, and a group wanted to bring in hygiene supplies, simple hygiene supplies, soap and toothbrushes and things like that. They wanted to leave them in what had been a field hospital run by a U.S. group. The U.S. group didn't want the hygiene materials there. They were afraid that there would be some sort of a riot, even though there had been no indication. It was just an example of how there are a lot of well-meaning people who want to help, and sometimes they just can't get connected.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to take your call shortly, 1-800-433-8850. Mark Schneider, we've talked about immediate relief for Haiti. What about some longer-term efforts to redevelop the situation there so that eventually this need for catastrophic aid will ease and Haiti will get back on its feet?
Well, I think that that's clearly the most, in a sense, it's the most important next step, and it should begin immediately. I would hope that, and I know that the U.S. government, the United Nations are beginning to engage with the government of Haiti. They need to be looking at a long-term reconstruction program that responds to the magnitude of this natural disaster. And that probably means that in the case of the United States and the rest of the world, the largest single reconstruction response that's ever occurred with respect to a single country. And it cannot be for 2 or 3 years. It needs to be, the first stage needs to be at least a decade, and probably the second stage a generation. And that means that there needs to be a vision, a Haitian vision, of moving to a point where they are less vulnerable, their buildings are less vulnerable, their institutions are less vulnerable to the kind of natural disasters that we've seen, and also to the political instability that Haiti suffered over the course of its history.
Well, Americans, of course, were very moved by the scenes of devastation and the desperate attempts to help people immediately after the earthquake. But do you think there will be support for an effort that lasts decades or a generation?
That's why you need to start now. And that's why I would hope that the Obama administration would move quickly in assessing with the UN and others the actual extent of the damage, which people are talking about in the range of $10 billion, and would begin to make an emergency supplemental available to the Congress to act on quickly. You can spend that over time. Remember, in the case of Hurricane Mitch, for example, there was a response. The estimate of damage was about $6.3 billion. The United States made an immediate emergency supplemental request of about $1 billion. And in the end, the U.S. in Latin America has basically provided between 30 and somewhere near 60 or 70% of the total bilateral grant aid for post-disaster relief and reconstruction, and also for post-conflict reconstruction.
Manuel, what do you see happening over the long term?
I think it's a very difficult and dark situation for Haiti. There were some efforts to develop the nation by international groups prior to this. A lot of that has been set back. But I'm curious, since Mark met with President Preval, and since President Preval has had such a low profile, you don't see him out on the streets in Port-au-Prince, you don't hear him on the radio. I'm just interested in what your assessment of his abilities to push this forward? And does he have a plan?
Well, I think that there are two issues here. One is President Preval in the last year of his administration, his personality. And I think that a lot of times we push him, and he has a better sense than we do of the underlying feel within the Haitian body politic and the Haitian community. And I will just say that many times, at least I've been mistaken, and he's been right. And I would hope that he understands the point at which he can come out and go public, if you will, with something that he can actually say, this is going to happen, and then the Haitian people will respond. But there needs to be a plan. He needs to identify, whether it's his prime minister, who's a former minister of planning, who's going to be the coordinator for Haitian reconstruction, and develop a plan that's aimed at responding to this kind of vulnerability in the past, that's aimed at decentralizing Haiti's economic and political life, and that's aimed at building up a Haitian state.
Certainly it would be a challenge even for the best-run government. We're going to take another very short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. We'll take some of your calls and questions, let you join our conversation, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents, and by PBS, presenting The National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, airing tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. This is NPR.
Tablets and gadgets, how Apple's iPad and other new multimedia devices may change the way we read, surf the web, watch TV, and stay in touch. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation about the situation in Haiti just 3 weeks after that terrible earthquake. We'll start in St. Louis and talk to Dimitri. Dimitri, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Suzanne. I have two questions that are very brief. How many of the personnel who are American respondents to the disaster in Haiti have had experience with Katrina? Because it seems to me the confusion going on in Haiti simply is a mirror image of what happened in Katrina, and I would hope that we gained enough experience to deal with that kind of disaster. And my question is, have they utilized the people who have had that experience? That's the first question. The second question is, as Haiti is a semi-protectorate of France, I never hear the name France involved in what is what the world is responding to this disaster. What is their participation? And I thank you if we can get a response or get someone in response to those questions.
Dimitri, thanks so much for your question. You met Manuel. I know that you spent some time in New Orleans after Katrina. Do you see parallels, though? Have we learned lessons from Katrina that were able to apply in Haiti?
I think the interesting thing to look at is the difference in expectations on the ground from the people who lived in New Orleans and the people who live in Haiti. In New Orleans, there was an expectation that some semblance of the old life would return. There was some faith that the government, even after its initial stumbles, would step in and take care of things. In Haiti, no such faith exists. In Haiti, no such expectation exists. And in some ways, if you want to look for something hopeful in all this, Haitians are almost better prepared emotionally to deal with this because the distance between their previous lives and their current plight is not as far as it would be, say, for us here in Washington, D.C., or for the people in Louisiana. Just to answer his questions very quickly, the French are involved. They have an embassy right downtown, and they're involved with the U.N. And while there are definitely people in Haiti from the United States who were involved in Katrina, the comparison that you saw more often was with September 11th. Because of the crews, some of the crews that had done the work at Ground Zero were also down in Port-au-Prince digging through the rubble. And from their work, we saw some of these amazing stories of rescues. And again, if there's a glimmer of hope, you saw some people who survived.
Mark, thinking about lessons learned, I was wondering for the international aid community, what about lessons learned from that terrible tsunami a couple years ago? Were there lessons from that that are being applied in Haiti?
I don't think there's any question that lessons are learned each time, whether it's Hurricane Mitch where, for example, as a result of Hurricane Mitch, the USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance pre-positioned a lot of these plastic tents and supplies in the Caribbean, in Florida, and had made arrangements with Southern Command for getting them to Haiti and to other places whenever a natural disaster occurred. They also were very active in the tsunami in Aceh in terms of trying to organize for the next stage, that is to recognize that this has got to be not just the relief but the reconstruction. And as you know, there was a UN effort that they created an actual reconstruction agency that assisted in the reconstruction. One of the differences, both in Katrina and in the tsunami and in other natural disasters, is that this earthquake destroyed the central economic and political core of the country. And so the government, which presumably in the case of the United States, Washington, was able to respond in Katrina and did a poor job. In the case of Haiti, they're sort of trying to grapple with the fact that their central capabilities have been destroyed. In the case of France, remember, no Haitian would say France, that they are a semi-protectorate of France. France was a colonial government 200 years ago. They've fought for and received their independence, but there is now a cooperative relationship. There's a French medical ship, I understand, coming, a French hospital ship, and they are engaged fully with the international community in the relief effort.
All right, let's talk to Amon, calling us from Southfield, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Susan. Thanks for taking my call. I just came back after 10 days from Haiti, and I cannot agree more with your guest from the State Department that we did meet a lot of children who've been separated from their parents, and we don't know if their parents are still alive or where exactly they are. So, and also, I'm not trying to defend the 10 Americans who tried to help these children, but for so many days after the earthquakes and up to last Friday when I came back to the state, the border between the Dominican and Haiti was easy to access in and out without anyone stopping you or asking you where you're going or what you're having. So I think their intention was good intention because, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of kids been abandoned. I mean, vividly in hundreds kids been abandoned, and you don't know where exactly these kids going to end up in. And just another comment, I was involved in Katrina as well as a part of the relief work that I belong to my organization, and it's two different disasters that I cannot compare the disaster in Katrina with the earthquake in Haiti. I mean, we did learn a lot from Katrina, But it's two different issues right here. Mm-hmm. I mean, to work in Haiti is not an easy, as many of your guests mentioned. It's not an easy operation there due to many, many aspects.
You know, Amin, thanks very much for your call. You have a sympathetic approach to these U.S. missionaries. We're getting a lot of emails from people who are outraged by them. Here's one. This emailer writes, I think you need to look at the possibility that fundamentalist Christian groups may be seeking to save children from the devil worshipers that caused the earthquake that Pat Robertson spoke to. These missionaries should be tried as kidnappers. Another email, the idea that a group of unregistered and unqualified people who call themselves missionaries go to a foreign country, swoop in and gather a group of poor and devastated children who they call orphans is outrageous. And just one more from Ernest, writing us in Silver Spring, Maryland, is part of the motivation to rescue these children simply to remove them from what is considered a bizarre religion in Haiti? What do we know about these aspects of this case?
The case keeps on getting stranger and stranger with the more details we learn, and we're seeing some pretty good journalistic sleuthing of late, I think. In the New York Times today, friend Ginger Thompson went to the little town where many of these kids came from and talked to some of the parents, and the parents said, well, we weren't giving away our children. That was not our intention. And I think they also sent a reporter to Idaho and found that the house where this group was registered was for sale as a foreclosed home, and nobody was there. So with each little detail, it gets a little stranger and a little bit weirder. But I think that people have to be careful not to rush to judgment. And it would be interesting to get a full accounting from the missionaries to find out exactly what their intentions were.
We have an emailer asking us, I've been trying to find online a way to, quote, adopt a Haitian orphan by sending financial support to an orphanage, but I'm not sure which organizations are reputable, and I can't find one that's specifically supporting Haiti. We have a lot of listeners who want to find ways to help. What advice would you give them, Mark?
I think that the United Nations has a central clearinghouse, a Save the Children. Obviously, it engages in this kind of activity. UNICEF does. My understanding is that PLAN also does. That is, they attempt to provide resources to the family in order to help the child. And I think that there's an Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs called ACHA at the United Nations, and they have a website where you can find that, along with the American Red Cross as well.
And what would be the website address for the United Nations agency?
www.ocha.org.
OCHA spelled?
O-C-H-A.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Sean. He's calling us from Keller, Texas. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the great show. My wife is a nurse, and I'm a police officer and security specialist. And we would like to go down there and help. And for anybody else who wants to help but doesn't have a passport, which we don't have, are there any plans by the State Department or any other government agency to help facilitate any passports so we can get some people with critical skills down to where they're needed?
Well, Sean, thanks very much for your call and for your generous offer. Mark, for people like Sean who have some skills, want to help, what should they do?
My understanding is that there are a couple of ways. Also, I'm just looking at a U.S. government site, www.usaid.gov/Haiti, www.reliefweb.int, which is, again, through ACHA. And my understanding is that there that'll lead you on to information about both individuals who want to help and where to send money.
All right, Sean, thanks very much. Let's go to Akron, Ohio, and talk to John. John, thank you for joining us.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Without you talking about what I have is almost like irrelevant, but I was always amazed that, from my memory, reading the paper back in 1976, around the time of our bicentennial, there was a quake in China. And from my memory, 650,000 people died the first day and 100,000 the second. And it was about the second or third page of the paper. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that I've just noticed what a different world we're in now, and I'm pleased at the response of everybody. But are you familiar with that? Am I accurate in my memory of that?
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Mark, you're nodding your head.
No, I think he's accurate. I can't give the actual figures, but it was probably that may be the number one in terms of loss of life. And what I was saying earlier is that if it turns out that in Haiti, near 150,000, if that may wind up being 200,000, it's going to put Haiti well up into one of the worst natural disasters. And if you take it against the size of the population, percentage of the population that's been lost, I don't think there's any question that it'll be one of the top two or three.
But I also think it's conceivable we may never know exactly how many people died in Haiti, because I can tell you, I witnessed mass graves where you had a big hole dug at the main cemetery in Port-au-Prince, and people were just driving by and dumping bodies there. The bodies were so numerous that they were hanging off the lip of the hole. The smell, the stench was overwhelming. It would bring tears to your eyes, not only emotionally, but physically, just from the odor. And I can remember going by that big hole a few days later, and there was a sign that said, "Please don't dump any more bodies. The hole is full."
What a story, and what a tragedy for families who will be looking for relatives, perhaps never to find them because they've been buried in these mass graves.
You have to imagine that in the first days after the quake, there were piles of bodies on street corners. I saw piles of bodies as if you were stacking up firewood, men, women, old people, children. It's hard to imagine that there was a proper accounting for all of those people. At the Central Hospital in Port-au-Prince, there were hundreds of bodies outside for days under the hot sun in Haiti. You can imagine what that smelled like, what it looked like, what a horrific situation it was. And people were in triage mode. They were looking to treat wounds and take care of themselves and take care of others. And it's hard to imagine that someone was there with a clipboard checking off the numbers.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls. Let's go back to the phones, talk to Michael. Michael, you've been holding on. Thanks for being patient.
Thank you greatly. And may I say at the beginning that Diane Rehm, I've seen her face on your website, is so much more beautiful than I ever thought. Because of the difficulty with her voice, I used to think for a long time that she looked like Washington Press Corps' Helen Thomas, whom I'm a big admirer of. But anyway, I'm so glad that one of the earlier callers had mentioned France earlier. The French government owes Haiti big time. So that'll leave me, I don't have to ask two questions, but I would like to make a comment after this first question. Where France comes in, and I'm so glad that one of your guests mentioned long-term economic development, it really needs to start at the village level. We've all, many of us have heard about, deforestation, that was the way that they paid their, Haitians paid their tribute to France by loading lumber onto, I assume, French ships, where they made French furniture from in the 19th century. And as an antiques collector, I'm very ashamed about that. And but also, Haitians needed it for firewood, and now many Americans are learning about, millions are learning slowly about the pernicious extent of child sexual slavery traffic in Haiti.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for your call. Mark.
I think your caller actually hit on a major issue in terms of Haiti's both the past problems in economic development and its future, and that is the deforestation. Haiti was covered 80% by forest in several centuries ago, 2% today. And so any kind of agricultural development requires an effort to ensure that you protect the hillsides and you protect the environment. And that in order to do that, you have to do something about energy in Haiti. The population uses charcoal for all of its cooking fuel, uses charcoal for burning for small businesses. The international community has to find a way to shift that so that it's not a draw to have people continue to destroy the remaining trees in the country.
Manuel?
I just also wanted to note for your caller's benefit that Mark and I are much more handsome than our voices, too. When you're in Port-au-Prince and you wake up in the morning, the first thing that assaults your senses is the smoke. The smoke is everywhere because they are using the charcoal for cooking, for warming their hands, for everything that you can imagine. And then the garbage is being burned, too. So the air quality in Port-au-Prince is awful, and the deforestation is exactly connected to that pattern for cooking.
Manuel Roig-Francia is with the Washington Post, and also joining this hour, Mark Schneider from the International Crisis Group. Thanks, both of you, for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.